Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast. Today's guest is Laura Taylor Navy. Laura wrote an own voices YA contemporary called The Cuban Girl's Guide to Tea and Tomorrow. In this interview, we chat about her writing and her books. Now let's go to an interview. Hi, Laura. Welcome to Retro Next podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, okay. I am a young adult author and I'm Cuban American, but I was born and raised in California. I'm really connected to my huge Cuban family though. I'm married with two teenagers at home and love writing for young adults. And A Cuban Girl's Guide to Tea and Tomorrow is my sophomore novel. My debut was, The Library of Lost Things came out last year and Cuban Girl's coming out about a year later. Which is really fun.
Exciting. I love this. So what inspired you to become a writer?
I think just there's always been a writer inside of me, but not necessarily a published author. And I think those things are different. I've always had a way with words and I did well in school. But I never thought I could write a full-length novel. I was more into short stories or shorter form works. And maybe I had a poetry concentration in college and I was a teacher. And I ended up using a lot of literature in my classes and taught creative writing. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I quit teaching and I had children and my daughter, my youngest child was around the fifth grade and all the new YA was coming out that my kids were interested in and their mm-hmm. friends. Like it was like the Hunger Games era and Twilight, mm-hmm. all of that. And I'm like, and I see the excitement, the kind of renewed excitement in YA. And I'm like, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. So I basically just sat down. I got this idea that wouldn't leave me alone and I started writing it. And I kind of had no training except for some of the just writing classes in college, just kind of more general, but nothing on like, not like an MFA or an English major or anything like that. And I basically taught myself how to write YA by just doing it. And that book though, that lives in a drawer where it, in its own little book coffin, where it is given flowers and visited every so often in its gravesite. And loved and respected for what it did for me, you know, just as an author. It taught me a lot. It taught me where, you know, I needed to grow and what I needed to learn. And I went on then in the next couple of years to pen my debut, The Library of Lost Things, which I think that one got an agent only after about 3 or 4 months querying and it sold in 3 months. Yeah. So after it, you know, after I think it was just my time, mm-hmm. it has gone pretty quickly, which is amazing. It's like a whirlwind. So mm-hmm. I'm really thankful.
That's fascinating. So what do you love about writing YA? Because it's like a unique genre, you know.
I love YA because it lets me go back and revisit all of the things I loved about being a teenager and some of the things I struggled through. Mm. And it's such a unique platform. It's an honor to be able to meet teens of today with something and be able to give them something from yourself and not necessarily like in a teaching way, but just to provide them with positive experiences and growing experiences through books. I think that's a gift and I really enjoy that.
Mm, I love this. So what is your writing process like? Do you follow an outline or do you see where this relates to you?
It's a mess. Mm. It's my precious mess.
Yeah.
That no one shall get in the way of. I don't outline, but I'm not a pantser. I always have a really, really strong idea of character first. And for me, it's not about the story or like the plot. It's about telling the story of one or two people. So I always start there with a really unique person who has a story. And then I build a story around that person and their unique backstory. So I really spend the most of my time creating my characters and their arcs and how then the story that I'm going to give them is going to pull them through a coming of age experience or an emotional growth. So that's mm-hmm. the way I start. I always know what happens to them in the beginning and the middle and the end, but I don't necessarily know what happens to them each and every scene. So I don't scene by scene plot. I might plot a few chapters and then write them. And then, you know, the world changes. Even though I'm steady with who my character is, that doesn't usually change. Like where they go and what they do and who they meet. The plot points might vary and kind of arise as I go. And I leave room for that. And then I write for a while, then I stop and I forecast the next few chapters or something and kind of see what's generally going on and where I need to get to. And I move that way until I get to the end. I don't write out of order.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty linear, but I do edit as I go, which is what every writing teacher will tell you not to do. And I do it all the time and it's fine for me. But I don't advise it, but I totally do it because it helps to keep me in the work when I'm stuck.
That makes sense. Like it keeps you, if you're stuck in one place and you look back and you kind of like just figure things out and it just helps you kind of like move forward.
Well, you know, it keeps me like, it's hard to be when everybody gets writer's block or whatever, or a point where you're like, I don't know what's going to happen next. And I don't know how to fix this, or I've written myself into a hole and I don't know. And while I have people in my critique groups and critique partners that are amazing to help me to process those things, it helps me to stay in my story by going back and being able to at least do something. I'm just the kind, that's just how my brain works. And like I said, most of my other writing friends do not work this way, and that actually hinders them, but it helps me. And so that's what, you know, when I tell new writers, do whatever works for you as long as it's successful.
Yeah, I love this idea. So let's talk about the Cuban's Girl's Guide to Tea and Tomorrow. That's a mouthful of a title.
I'm sorry, world, about that. Yes, that title was... This is the source of much wordplay, many months of back and forth between agents and editors and people that, you know, make decisions. And yeah, and while we love it, we hate the hashtag, you know, so, because it's so long whenever anyone Instagrams. And then you miss one letter and it's like, oh gosh, I got to go back and fix. There's two A's in there, you know?
Oh my gosh. So yeah. What was the source of inspiration?
The source of inspiration is definitely my own Cuban family and growing up being a part of that whole. And I so wanted to tribute people that raised me and loved me and some of the experiences I went through that kind of enabled and that were my coming of age. And this was the way to do it. And instead of, I encapsulated the feel and the shapes and the sounds and the taste, definitely the taste of my childhood and my growing up, and mixed them with my teenage years and how I was as a teen. And I took all of that, and there's a spirit of that. And I embodied that spirit into Lila Reyes, who's my main character, and kind of reformed those experiences and gave them to one girl, which was really fun and really emotional. It's largely autobiographical in that the people that you meet in the book are based off of real people. And some of them I lost while I was writing the book. And so it made it extremely difficult and emotional for me. But it was also, again, like I was saying, a gift to be able to have a place to put them.
Mm-hmm. I love the story. I love what it represents. I love that it's a Cuban American experience. You know, fish out of water, it represents struggles between Miami, where we see a lot of Cuban American community. But, you know, I could see myself, and as I mentioned earlier, I grew up in Puerto Rico, and I could see myself like having similar experience to Lula going back to my hometown, you know, and then being fish out of water and being in England, you know, and like missing things from home, you know, the weather is different, the whole sense of feeling, you know. I think it represents like something that's not unique, but it's actually that other people, you know, can experience too.
Well, thank you. And that's exactly what I wanted a reader to feel, that, and especially Latinx readers. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not Cuban, you know, you come from another Latinx community. I kind of wanted to take you home, mm-hmm. And put you inside your own feelings and let you have a place to experience maybe some of, and reconcile maybe some of your own feelings, mm-hmm. As a member of that community and that culture and a family. Mm-hmm. I just think it's important that we stop and we remember where we came from and where we're going in our identities.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really the goal that I wanted to explore.
Yes, it was really present. I think for me, like I can see myself like being Lila's story of, like, you know, the idea, like, I left home at 18 and I went to a foreign place. I went to Syracuse, which is, like, completely cold, and I was unprepared, and just like Lila, I was, like, in England, like, completely unprepared from, like, going from warm weather to basically, like, a foreign place where not everything that you're used to, the comfort, the feels, the food are all different and foreign, and then finding home, you know, in that place.
And and it's so funny because people don't understand, and I think some readers that have not been to England before really do not understand how cold it is in June there. Mm-hmm. They're like, why are there so many squares? Like, why is there so much tea? Like, it's cold. I went there in June to London and all around England, and I had a scarf, a beanie, like boots, a coat, a raincoat. It was raining. My children were in raincoats. It was cold. It would only, and then it would kind of a little bit get warmer, but I was never in like shorts and a tank top, not until August. And then she does change her clothes. You know, she's wearing maxi dresses later, but people don't realize how cold June is in England. It is like, you know, it's not my, and especially for a Miami girl, she's going to be going like, what is going on? It's supposed to be hot at home. It's humid. It's at 95 degrees. And, you know, so it almost, it's funny because reviewers are saying it feels like a fall book with fall motifs done in the summer, and how interesting that is. I'm like, well, yeah, because it's real. Like, you can't, if I had her in her, the way she sprite packs, which I think is fun, in her tank tops and shorts and flip flops in June, she's going to freeze, especially, you know, and she does.
So what was the research process like? Because this book starts in England, but there's also Miami too. Like, there's a feeling of both locations. Like, you feel like you're both places. What was that research process for you?
A lot of it was just from memory, because I've spent tons of time in Miami and I have been to England, and I have British friends who helped me extensively with the, I have a friend who I, you know, I picked Winchester because I have a friend who lived there for 10 years. So she really helped me just with the ins and outs and the small things that you don't know unless you're a citizen of a place, you know, like, it's really like this. And even though some is fictitious, a lot of it is real. So I did consult, you know, it was different levels of research as far as books. My own family history is real, like the abuela, what happens to her? It was my mother, the experience there. And I have in my family, we did not own a Cuban bakery, but my cousin had a Cuban eatery that was like a lunch place in Orlando, where people would come and have cubanos, and it was kind of like in a business park, where, and they, it was just packed. So they had a successful Cuban eatery, a restaurant, like a cafe that was small, like a limited hours. But so we, you know, that was part of my family. I'm a huge Anglophile. I love Europe. I love the UK. And after I went there, I was so inspired just by the antiquity and all the tea, the coziness, the, the beauty, the landscape. And for me, writing is about combining ideas and expanding, because when you combine things, it makes them both bigger on themselves. It makes them bigger than the sum of their two parts. So that is how this book was born. It was combining everything I knew and loved about Miami and that experience, and everything I knew and know and love and learned about England and that experience, and trying to use each of them to pull the other forward and say something about both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it just, it sold me.
Thank you.
Really did. For me, it was just like, I don't know. I think it's like, when I think about that, it's like a unique Latinx book. Like, because I wouldn't think of, when we think of Latinx books, we think about like California, Miami, like all these locales, and we didn't think of England, you know, to be like a common age story of, you know, Cuban American, you know, like growing up, you know, like in this foreign world. Like,
and that's purposeful, because for me, you know, something I'm passionate about is the notion that there's diversity within our diversity, and not everybody's story has to go to the reader the same way. Mm-hmm. And that we are many stories, even in, you know, I read a lot of Cuban books by other Cuban American authors, you know, from native writers. Mm-hmm. And those stories have things that didn't happen in my family. And I'm like, that's so great. Not every story has to be the story of Miami Cuban in Hialeah or Little Havana, you know, or and even though I have some of that, not, and the ones that are fabulous, we need those. We need the ones who are, you know, that are more about people being a citizen of the world. And that's what Lila learns to be. And she's not really, doesn't have that mindset early on. She's very much a, you know, a citizen of 305. She's Miami. She is West Dade, Little Havana. That's her world. And that is like this, the boundaries there. So for me, I think the more we can expand storytelling to encompass a wide variety of experiences within cultures and from Native writers, that's what we need. And that's what we should see on shelves. So I advocate for that. And I did it. And, you know, not everyone understands. And I did get some not criticism, but some questioning, like, well, why are you writing your story in England if it's about a Miami girl? I'm like, well, why not? Isn't she a part of the world too? And that kind of stops the conversation usually right there. They're like, oh yeah, she is. I'm like, oh yeah. And, you know, my critique partners were saying they actually enjoyed learning about the Cuban culture and not being told what it is, but actually being shown what it was, because Lila was showing her friends, her new friends, and having to state who she was and live who she is. And that was because she was kind of, they were living it through her eyes and through the eyes of her friends there, and Orion and his group. So it was like not being shown something, but being included in it. Being included in the watching and learning. And I thought, well, that's good. I'm glad that they did that. It was more, you know, that wasn't necessarily my goal. My goal was just to say, we are more than our zip code and more than our genetic pool, that we are part of this great world and we are not lessened. If we go somewhere else, we're not less Cuban or less Puerto Rican or less anything. You know, we are who we are.
Yeah. And I think it just reflects the fact that, you know, there's a diaspora, you know, like our community is not monolithic. It's not just like one culture and they all live in the same place and they all live happily after. Like, we have moved, we have changed, we are living everywhere in the world, you know, so
it's. Well, I live in that world. Yeah. You live in that world. We, this is the new, this is how it is, as you know, we diversify, we move, we, you know, that is humanity.
Yeah. So let's talk about the food.
I was waiting.
Oh my gosh. I was so hungry. I grew up in panaderias. I grew up with cubanos, medianoche, which I don't find them very often in up north, which is like so sad. Croquetas, empanadas. You know, I am just making the listener just get hungry. You just need to find a Cuban place or even a Puerto Rican place. You might be able to find these foods. So what was your research process like? Mashing up Cuban food with English food, which is actually even unique. So.
Well, I am a huge foodie. So these are the foods I grew up on that my tías and tíos made, that my mother made. She would make arroz con pollo all the time. That was what I grew up on. That was like the quintessential. It's so cliche, like arroz con pollo. You see the abuela making arroz con pollo. It's like, you know, hello, it's such a Cuban cliche, but I don't care because it's real. I ate that like twice a month. Right. And I would go to spend extensive time with my family, with my tías, and I have a huge Cuban family. I mean, this is like my big fat Greek wedding Cuban style. I mean, there's people everywhere. There's like millions of cousins. And all we did was like cook. It was like in the kitchen. That's where you come of age. That's where you learn what life is. That's where you learn who you are and who we are. And so many life lessons were, and so much of my emotional education was done over plates and spoons and knives and pots and seeing these foods. And, you know, I come from a family of incredible cooks and I watched them make these things and I helped. I got to help and learn how to do them and I got to eat them. And I have a, it's stamped in my system. This is like my, this is my, the food I come from. So I had to just tribute these things. I do have a wonderful Cuban bakery. If you live in San Diego, Azucar is wonderful. Azucar is just in Ocean Beach. It's fantastic. They have a wonderful Cubano sandwich, of which my husband had to make regular trips down there to get them for me, as well as patalito de guayaba. They have croquetas, they have everything. So I would go down there, talk to them. I'd order a bunch of things just to, I photographed them. If you go to my Instagram, you can see pictures of the book with these foods. And I've done some blog posts. When you, when my blog tour happens, you can see the foods Lila makes and I talk about them. So basically it's just me eating around the world and then consulting my mother and how to do things. As far as the British foods, my friends helped me, as well as I have been in England and did eat all of these things and did drink all of the different types of tea that are in the book. I did go to the indie tea houses and stores and to see how it's such a tea culture. That's very important. Mm-hmm. And I had every word vetted by Cuban cooks and English citizens who know food and baking and some of the recipes. You know, I had them check my work. That's part of my research process. And more than just eating, just learning, you know, especially as Lila is cooking them, I wanted to get the processes right. So I did a lot of food blog reading to see, you know, real Cubans cooking real food, not like somebody in, you know, Arizona that is, you know, not ever had, not Cuban or never had Cuban food trying to make badly like boliche or something like that. Like in the right sazon, like we're using completely, like trying to put chili powder in there or something. Like I have seen that, things like that. I wanted, you know, the authentic, most authentic representations of this food. To start with, as I, you know, built the food story in my story.
Mm-hmm. I love this because I feel like food is like such a unique part of our culture, and it's like it's a big part of it. It's our what we connect with. That's why we go for weddings. By the way, I love the centerpiece. That also
okay. Hello, this I'm sorry to like my tias. That is me roasting the heck out of them. This is so real. This was me. I used to be on like dun 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 centerpiece watch 5,000. You know, they would put me and I would come home. You know, there's a wedding every summer. I had 50,000 cousins, you know. Mm-hmm. And we would come out of there with like arms full, and that was the goal. And we'd set them all up and my tia's, you know, on her table. And I'm like, why did we do this? Like, but that was every wedding. It's not a party. It's not a fiesta unless you have a centerpiece. It's not a baby shower. It's not an event unless there's flowers on the table that you can take.
Yeah, they have all these vases at the end of the day. They have all these vases left over.
My goodness. It's complete ridiculousness. And this is why I told my tia, she's read this. And I said, by the way, I just roasted you. You'll know what it is. And she's like, oh, I'm scared. I'm like, you should be. It's okay, I love you, but I had to put this in here because this is, again, just like the Guano Sanch and the Medianoche, this is stamped on my identity. The centerpieces have never left me. Believe it, my wedding, when they came to San Diego where I got married 20 years ago, at my wedding, guess who was taking all the cute topiary centerpieces from my wedding? Those tias, they were doing a patch of their hotel rooms. It did not stop. You know, it came full circle. So, it's so funny.
Yeah, it's just like, I think it just, for me as someone who grew up in Puerto Rico, who has lived in the United States for about 20 years now, like it just reminded me, it was like coming back home. Like I just saw Violet. Lila's story is just like home for me, of being a fish out of water. And so to try to merge all these identities, all these cultures, you know, into what it looks like new normal, you know.
Yeah. It's an interesting space to, you know, to storytell from. Mm-hmm. And I think one that needs to be explored and one that needs to be talked about.
Yeah. So thank you. And thank you for writing the Cuban American experience, like in a way that feels relatable.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it was almost terrifying for me because I was very adamant of like, I want to write this story the way I want to write it. You know, I don't want to necessarily do the same story over and over. I want to do something different. And I want to write what's in my heart. And I want to combine these things differently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm so grateful. And I understand that not everyone appreciates the way that a storyteller tells her story. And that is the beauty of publishing and literature. There's a story for everyone and not every story is for every reader. And I completely respect that. But I have gotten so many messages like what you were saying, people in my DMs, Cuban Americans, Puerto Ricans, other members of Latinx communities that are like, thank you for putting our stories into print that we can revisit them and give them to our daughters and sons. And, you know, thank you for having the word Cuban on a cover. Thank you for having our hair, which is my hair, by the way. Thank you for having our food. You know, just the fact the representation, they was really appreciated. And it's something that I think my publisher did such a beautiful job to make sure that they were representing the cultural beauty of the story and putting the cultural elements in the forefront. And the illustrator of my book, Andrea Poretta, is just wonderful. In that, you know, the way she did this and was careful to consult with me from everything, you know, to Lila's skin tone, to the way the pastries look, and the you know, the care that my art director, Karen Lee, did with the Miami colors, with the English countryside, saying, you know, we're going to, you married these things and we're going to marry them. Mm. And then give the reader, yeah, I think, you know, with the seafoam and the guava color, you know, you have Lila's guava, but you have the Winchester Cathedral and the and St. Catherine's Hill, which are Orion's things. So I just, like, when I saw that cover, I'm like, thank you, because you you got me. You know, you got what I'm trying to do in the words, and you put that on the front so that readers can say, oh my goodness, that's interesting. Like, it's England, but it's pink, you know? So yeah, and I think it sparks conversation, which is fun.
Oh, I'm so excited. I'm excited for readers to find your book and to discover this beauty.
Thank you.
So what are some of your upcoming projects?
Oh, okay. Well, I am on deadline right now, which is really busy. I have a secret, not a secret, sort of secret YA project with the same publisher that's coming out next year. And all I can say, that book is not launched yet, so I can't really say too much about it, but I will say that it is a friendship book.
Ooh. So,
yes, it is that the friendship is the big theme.
Okay.
And yeah, like friendship breakup, maybe friendship stuff. So that, yeah. So a little different, but still in my brand, but a little different turn, you know. And I'm really excited about it. This project, it will be launched soon in a few months, and you'll be able to see the cover and the name and all of that. Again, coming from Athenaeum Simon and Schuster. I'm not sure which month, but it will, it is slated for fall 2021. And while I got my edits, you know, during COVID, we've been home a lot, and not that I'm not home a lot anyway, just being an author in my cave, you know, I started another story. And this one is set in Los Angeles in Echo Park, which has a huge Cuban history. Mm-hmm. And this is right up the road from me. And so this time I am writing about cultural erasure and the Cuban experience in this golden era that Cuban Americans and Cuban immigrants had. When they came from Miami, they landed in Miami and they were given, you know, $100 in a jacket. Mm-hmm. And they could go, and a lot of them were encouraged to come to Los Angeles, and they set up this huge community near Dodger Stadium in Echo Park. And I'm writing from two families that have, it's kind of enemies to lovers, with probably the largest Latinx cast I have ever done. Mm. I'm talking 99.9% Latinx, which I'm so excited about. There are Puerto Ricans, there are Dominicanas, there are everything, because that is what Los Angeles is. And Cubans and Mexicans, everything, all kinds of, you know, huge, huge Latinx cast, which has been awesome, because, you know, Cuban Girls Guide has like half and half, but this one is just completely a different turn, with the irritants to lovers backbone going on with the romance in there, which is so much fun. So yeah, that's what I'm working on now, which, you know, who knows when that's going to be done, because I'm kind of busy with edits and, you know, promoting Cuban Girl right now. Those things are in the forefront of my day. But I'm anxious to get back to that. And I hope to, you know, around the holidays, to go back to writing that. So I'm plenty busy. I don't.
Yeah. I'm so excited for these projects. Like, I can't wait. So now let's go to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity to share with the audience what they should read next. What is your favorite genre?
I love like a female lead with a coming of age story, kind of like what I write. I love all of that. Maybe like a little romance arc in there. That's really fun for me. I do love fantasy too. I love everything, but I kind of read a lot in the genre that I write in, just so I can keep with the flow. You know, you want to see what your friends are doing and make sure, you know, it's just an awareness of how you fit in what is currently being published on and on. So I really like that genre.
What has been a book that you read this past year that you love?
I would recommend Furia by Shamile Mendez. Mm-hmm. Shamile Said Mendez is her whole name. And that book is really amazing. So I would definitely check that out. Just recently came out. It's wonderful. Yeah, that's a good one.
I love this. Thank you, Laura, for being on the show. Tell us where we can find you online.
Oh, you can find me, you know, I'm always online. I'm on Twitter, Laura T. Namey. You can find me on Instagram at Laura_Namey. And then just myfullname.com is my website. Please visit me, DM me, say hi. I would love to see, you know, to chat with you and whatever. I'd love to chat with readers. So please welcome to my social media family.
Awesome. Thank you, Laura, for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Laura.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, rate, and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Once you connect with fellow romance readers and make new friends, get weekly book recommendations, attend monthly meetups, then join our Patreon community. You can join at whatyourrenextblog.com/Patreon. Romance lovers, check out Queen Bee Reads Etsy shop for cute and comfortable bookish apparel. The shop also features social justice apparel and fun items from some of your favorite TV shows like The Schitt's Creek and The Office. Use code WHATTORead10 to save. Visit whatyourrenextblog.com/QueenBeeReads. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Discover new podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourrenextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.